A new show on the Comics in Motion Network comes to you from Matthew B. Lloyd of Classic Comics. Earth 2 in the Bronze Age. Imagine twin Earths, each the image of the verdant globe on which we live. Imagine these two worlds forever separated by a limbo of interdimensional space. Identical planets, evolving separately across the millennia. Each witnessing the birth of man, then the dawn of civilization. And finally, the beginning of the age of superheroes. On one world we'll call Earth 2, the superheroes begin to arrive in the early part of the 20th century when a rocket ship brought the star child Kal-El to safety. Kal-El begins his career as Superman in the early days of World War II as the first of the great heroes. Soon he was joined by other heroes, and they joined forces to form the first super team in history, the Justice Society of America. Thus the two worlds knowingly coexist, one inhabited by the familiar Flash, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, and other heroes of the Justice League, and the other Earth by the original superheroes. These are the legendary members of the Justice Society. Available only on the Comics in Motion Network, found wherever your podcasts find you.
Welcome to Classic Comics, everyone. My name is Matthew B. Lloyd, and I will be your guide as we explore the world of comics before the advent of the Silver Age. Thanks for tuning in to the Comics in Motion Network. Before we get started, remember you can follow the Classic Comics Show on Twitter at ComicsLloyd or contact the show via email at classiccomicsmbl@gmail.com. You can also find me on Twitter at MattB_Lloyd and at DCComicsNews.com, where I'm assistant editor and write reviews. In the notes section, you can find the Amazon link to Black Panther and Philosophy, What Can Wakanda Offer the World, the Black Panther book to which I've contributed. And you can also check out my chapter in Politics in Gotham, The Batman Universe and Political Thought, co-authored with Ian Drake. Additionally, my co-author Ian Drake and I have turned in the first draft for another volume on Batman, Arkham Souls, The Villains and Villainesses of Gotham. I don't have a publication date for this yet. I'll be sure to share more when I can. Currently, there's a search for a new publisher for the project, so hopefully there'll be some positive news on that front soon. On to the show! Episode 33. I'm so happy to have you join me for this episode as we take a look at DC Comics' other Golden Age team, the Seven Soldiers of Victory. And to do it, I have a special guest with me, mandatory, Max Bolton Byrne. You'll know Max from his podcast on the Comics in Motion Network, Mandatory Marvel and DC, and the sound alike, Mandatory Music and CD. Max, how are you doing today?
Hi there. I am great. Thanks, Matt. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm honored to be on this show. I'm a big fan of yours and your show. So finally, I get to be on there and talk about a great subject. So thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, you are very welcome. Thanks for joining. You've had me on a couple times, so I'm glad to have you on to talk about something on my show. Most of my shows are solo shows, but you know, I'm always looking to expand the format to include more guests, and this hopefully is the first of some new shows that are going to, you know, bring in some other guests from around the comic book fan world. We've been getting this episode together for a while. It's a shame real life takes precedence over comics and podcasts.
It is, isn't it? Especially at this time of the year when everyone's so busy for the Christmas holidays and gearing up for that. So I'm glad we've managed to find a transatlantic window, so to speak.
Well played. If I recall, we were discussing the Stargirl TV show, I think, when the idea for doing this episode came up. Am I remembering that correctly?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, because obviously they were heavily referenced in that show. In either, I can't remember if it was the first season or it might have been the first season. I think it was, when we obviously got that wonderful picture, didn't we, that was in Pat Dugan's collection of the original lineup, and there's a lot of references to them, and of course in Stargirl, of course the Shining Knight played quite a big part as well, so that really sort of brought them back across my radar, really. So yeah, we were chatting about that, and obviously yeah, it would be great to have a chat about the team and learn a bit more. Great stuff.
Absolutely. It was a great reference. I was quite surprised when they had the picture of the original lineup and the Star Rocket. I think Star Rocket Racers, and they're all standing around the car too. And it's just like, wow, such a odd set of Golden Age characters to have on a TV show. That, I mean, who'd ever think you'd see those guys on a TV show? So this is a neat opportunity to talk about some characters that some people I'm sure really love. Some people maybe don't know a whole lot about them, but you know, they've been on my radar for a very long time. But that's kind of where I wanted to start was, you know, I think I probably encountered them in the 70s or 80s in a Justice League issue or something like that. I remember them publishing a unused script that had drawn by contemporary artists that they serialized in a book. And actually, I thought it was Justice League, but I looked it up and it was actually Adventure Comics during the Fleischer Apero Spectre run. And of course, later on during All-Star Squadron, Shining Knight shows up in the first story arc and plays a pretty big role in that story arc. And then the whole team gets their appearance and reference later on. And of course, the Star Spangled Kid was the first soldier I ever encountered during his JSA days in All-Star Comics 65. I got that as a brand new comic in 1976 as a little kid. I was just confused why Captain America looked so different, because my understanding of comics was limited, obviously. And I just kept thinking, the guy in the cost, that's got to be Captain America, right? Well, it's not Captain America. I'm sorry. It's somebody else. But that was my first introduction to the JSA also. So what about you, Max? Where did you first hear about the Seven Soldiers of Victory?
Well, the first time I came across the characters was when I was a kid, probably, I don't know, maybe I was age 6 or 7. So this would have been about 1987, 1988, maybe. I had a copy, although it came out in 1981, I had a copy. I think my mum must have picked it up from a flea market or something like that, of All-Star Squadron number 1.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So if you remember the cover, I think it's Hawkman, Dr. Midnight, and one of, I think it's the Atom. The original. That's it.
Yep.
The Al Pratt Atom. And they're stood around a table with sort of pictures of all these superheroes that they're looking to recruit. Yes. And virtually all of the Seven Soldiers there, aren't they, on that table? You've got Green Arrow, Shining Knight, Star Spangled Kid and Stripesy, Crimson Avenger, and Vigilante. Virtually the entire lineup is amongst pretty much what is JSA characters.
You are right. I didn't think about that when I was preparing, but now that you say it, that you're 100% correct. That's one of those neat covers that sometimes gets homaged, and you're exactly right. They are all on that cover, aren't they, in some form or another?
Yeah. So I'd never heard of, you know, these characters, and you know, some of them are very intriguing. So I'd never until more recent years, had even read anything to do with the Seven Soldiers' victory, because it was such a relatively sort of short-lived team, weren't they, at least in their original incarnation, and they hadn't sort of gone into comics folklore to the same degree as the JSA or indeed the JLA. So they were more of a niche team in terms of like the general audience.
So that's definitely
So in terms of the actual characters that make up primarily the whole of the original lineup, that's where I first came across from that wonderful picture. And I've still got the comic in the long box downstairs. So at some point I might treat myself to a flick through it again and just see where it takes me. But yeah, in terms of the characters, that was me. Yeah, it came out in 81, but obviously I was 2 years old in 81. So we're talking mid-80s for me, yeah, as a young boy.
Okay. Well, I remember that comic very well. That was that comic to me is very rereadable, that first issue of All-Star Squadron.
Yes.
It's a great revisit for you when you do. I mean, I have single issues of the entire All-Star Squadron run that I got when they were coming out back in the 80s. Yeah. So that's one of my all-time favorite series. You know, one of the last things to go as I sell my old comics, that's going to be one of the last ones, because that was just an all-time favorite. And he touches on every Golden Age character, I think, possible that he can. He even works in the Golden Age Aquaman eventually by the end of the run. So I'm glad to hear you mention that. That's a happy thought right there. That's a real happy thought.
Absolutely, yeah. It's good stuff. And I'm quite sentimental towards it because it does link me back to my childhood too.
Very nice. Well, let's look at a little historical stuff really quickly. As you went out and you got the Archives Volume 1 that reading from, obviously. So this story is from Leading Comics number 1, and that's the first appearance of the Seven Soldiers of Victory. And when you go through the introduction, I can't claim this is original research, but it's in the introduction. The success of the Justice Society prompted National to do another team book under their national banner instead of All American Comics. And are you familiar with that split in the Golden Age between All American and National Comics?
Yeah, they were operating under two different editors, weren't they? Harry Donenfeld for National and Max Gaines for All American.
Yes.
And so I think it was under All American, wasn't it, where they went with this. So I don't know the history as to why DC had split as such. You know, I understand it was, but I don't quite understand what the reasoning for that was at that time.
My understanding is that it started out as two separate, like, publishers under one larger company.
Yeah.
And so you had this, so they were all together in a sense, but you had one set of editors on one side and another set on another side. And the All-Star Comics was where they actually mixed for the first time and had characters appearing in other titles, like, you know, like, so National was like action, detective, adventure, more fun. And All American was All American, Flash Comics, Sensation Comics. So when you look at like World's Finest Comics in the Golden Age, there was Batman and Superman, right? Those were all the national characters in another book. Whereas the comic Cavalcade was the All American equivalent, where you had Flash, Green Lantern, and Wonder Woman. So it's like two separate, you know, like the DC, the National Trinity would have been Batman, Superman, Batman, and Robin, and All American would have been Flash, Green Lantern, and Wonder Woman. That's those are the big characters from both companies. And so with All-Star, they brought the biggest characters together. And so National wanted to have their own thing. So they got Mort Weisinger, who was known for co-creating Green Arrow and Aquaman and Johnny Quick. And I guess, Vigilante also.
Yes.
And they put them in this new title called Leading Comics. And that was their behind the scenes motivation for getting together another super team. Although, as you mentioned, they are not nearly as well known to comics history as the Justice Society of America.
No, definitely not. No, I think obviously they came after the Justice Society, didn't they? So they kind of, and I guess the Justice Society picked heroes that were sort of better known, weren't they? Whereas a lot of the characters for the Seven Soldiers, at least at the time, were lower, second, third tier kind of guys, weren't they?
Yeah, I think it's odd to think that this is like the best group they could have gotten who weren't already taken. You know, that's kind of how you think about it. But they were, I think they only pulled from National Comics stuff, though. They didn't pull from any All-American, because all of these characters were National characters. I'm looking at it right now. And Green Arrow was in More Fun. Crimson Avenger was in Detective. Shining Knight was in Adventure. Vigilante was in Action, and Star Spangled Kid and Stripesy were in Star Spangled Comics. It sounds like it's their own title, but they were just couple other features. But they were the lead feature in that. So that's where we're starting. Interestingly, there's not a lot of superpowers among these guys, but lots of sidekicks.
Oh yeah, the sidekicks for days in this group. But I don't mind the fact that there's not a lot of superpowers here. You know, I always do kind of gravitate towards the lesser powered heroes anyway. You know, you can relate to them a bit more, can you, than someone who is all powerful. You know, I think that's why Batman's always been my favorite and always will be. So I don't mind that. I suppose only Shining Knight would be vaguely powered, wouldn't he? At least, well, or his horse, at least, I suppose.
Oh the flying horse, of course. Yeah, he's I guess his he has the super, or the not the super, but the armor that is magical armor, and he's got the sword. I think there's a magical element to his sword, but I don't know that we see much of it. I know the magical armor plays a part in something I've read recently, which is either this and I'm forgetting, or it's one of the Justice League issues that I'm reading for the other show that we're going to have a nice little synergy when this show comes out. That one will just have been finished up, so I'm looking forward to seeing that play out.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant stuff.
So we got on our cover, oddly, it's the Seven Soldiers Victory, but there's only five characters, or six characters, but it says five features. And that that comes into play where we discuss kind of the number of characters actually in this, on this team, which is debatable at times. And I'm sure we'll have a little bit of fun with that eventually.
I know, it's a very odd name for a group where the sort of numbers sort of fluctuate a little bit, don't they? But
they do.
Yeah, it's a great they do. It's really strange, but it's a great cover. At least it just I guess Pat Dugan was busy that day.
Yeah, he didn't make it, but even though he's part of the title of that strip, Star Spangled Kid and Stripesy.
Yeah.
And I don't think exactly Speedy is ever part of the Green Arrow title. It's just Green Arrow. I've read. So I don't know. That'll be fun to talk about. So the cover here and the opening chapter are both drawn by Mort Meskin. And what are your first thoughts as we get going, Max? The cover, the splash page with these characters for the first time. What are your first thoughts when you got going with this? Or have you already kind of...
I love the cover. I think it's great. I think I like the fact that it's on a plain yellow background, so the characters can speak for themselves. So it's not a really busy image, and they're very well put together on there. I like the fact that Green Arrow and Speedy are kind of jumping into the scene as opposed to just standing around with their arms folded like a couple of the other guys. So it leaps off the page. As a kid in 1941 when this came out, this would have been like, oh wow, this looks pretty great. Yeah. So I think it would have captivated readers. And like you said, that splash page as well, when you turn over the page and they do actually give Pat Dugan a place on the on the roster finally. Again, cool image. It shows them all. It shows you exactly who you're getting. It lists them all at the top of the page. So, you know, I guess as a consumer back then, before you part with your money, before you part with your however much it was it 10 cents? Yeah, 10 cents.
10 cents, yeah.
Exactly. Oh, that seems like a long time ago. You know exactly what you're getting. So yeah, I think it does exactly what it sets out to do. This is who's in it. This is what you can expect. And let's go. It's a good way to entice a reader, I think.
Yeah. You mentioned 1941, and I forgot to mention that the cover date is winter 1941. This is a quarterly comic. So this is right. coming out sometime, probably September, October, when a winter issue would have hit back yeah. then. And you mentioned the yellow background. That, to me, it reminds me of the All-Star number 3 issue, the cover of that, where the JSA is at the table with on the yellow background, that same bright yellow. Right. I'm sure that bright yellow stood out on the stands when you were looking at the massive amount of comics back then. You saw something bright and yellow like that. And then the characters, like you mentioned, just popping off the page in their contrasting colors. You know, I'm sure it was really noticeable at the beginning. They would have seen some sales just from it popping like that. And probably kids didn't have a lot of money. Yeah. So the 10 cents they had to spend was, you know, they were careful with where it went to.
Exactly. Yeah. If money was scarce, you know, this is during World War II as well. Although, you know, yeah, so I suppose it would have been, yeah. It,
you know, for you.
It would have had to be.
It's World War II for you, yeah. but not for exactly. me yet.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm always sketchy on the dates as to when the USA joined in, but it's a different time. So obviously you've got to be quite selective with what you buy. That's not too different from the times we live in.
That sounds pretty, yeah. Pretty relatable right yeah. now. It's just the comics aren't 10 does, cents. Yeah. If only they were.
I know, right? God, I'd be able to buy everything. I think it does a really good job, like we said, of you know, enticing the reader. I think if I was a young comics consumer in 1941, this certainly would have grabbed my attention.
Absolutely. So we get started, and the story is broken down into a quick sort of setup chapter, and then each character or each feature, I can't say character because each feature has like two characters, except for the Shining Knight. Everybody else has there's two people in the strip, which is kind of interesting. It almost could have been the 10 Soldiers of Victory if they played their cards right.
right.
But then we get it broken down to their stories and then a wrap-up chapter. What did you think of the storytelling format? Have you read any other stories like this? Are you familiar with the Golden Age Justice Society format this is based on?
Yeah, it's kind of different, isn't it? Because it's everyone separated into their own adventure. Although this is a team story and a team book, there's not a lot of teamwork, so to speak, is there? It's they're all going off on their individual quests to thwart a particular villain, and then they come back together at the end. So I do like the fact that they all get their individual spotlights, and you can focus in just on that character. Yeah, I do like the storytelling on it. It's quite unusual in a way because all the characters, although this is a team book, they're all split up into their own individual stories with each character or characters plural, I should say, because as you said, everyone's got someone in tow. They're all set off on their individual quests, and then at the end, they come together for a bit of teamwork at the end. So I do like the fact that they all get that individual spotlight and a chance to shine, and you get to focus in just on their adventure. But for a team book, it's quite unusual because there's no real teamwork. It's all separate antics. But, you know, I don't mind it at all. I think it's a good device especially if you're new to these characters as well and you've picked up this team book, you get to spend enough time with each character, I guess, to learn about them.
You know, I think it's something that I hadn't thought about, but just as you were saying that, I immediately thought of a couple other things I've read that are long form, meaning like a whole comic. I mean, the whole comic is devoted to this one story, this one long yeah. story with different chapters, right? And, yeah. you know, we're used to these comics in the Golden Age being anthology books where you have five or six different features in a book, but this is one story that manages to do both, have one long story plus essentially individual stories. And you made a great point about the individual spotlight on the characters, but it also made me think I have just been reading the first volume of Timely's Young Allies comics okay. from the 40s it's Toro and Bucky with a couple other non-powered characters, but their stories are book length. They go through the whole book. but it's divided into chapters, but it's not individual character stories. It's they're all working together like we would think of in a modern Justice League story where they're all together and working together. So this must have been a conscious decision on DC's part to do it like this, as opposed to you know, what Timely was doing with their only team book at the time, oddly, a bunch of kids. But you know, the early, I think as far as I've gotten so far in the Human Torch archives, those stories are like 40 page stories for just Human Torch and Toro. They're divided into chapters, but they're not like a 12 or 13 pager, like, you know, Batman, the first Batman comics that are Batman, not detective. It's like four different Batman stories, not connected whatsoever. And Human Torch is like one 40 page story of him and Toro, which is kind of different for the time. And it also made me think of that first Golden Age Daredevil number one, the Daredevil Battles Hitler. And that's another book length story where he actually has help from one of the other characters that he in the comic he was in, Silver Street Comics, show up. And it's more like that. The Young Allies is more like that. It's interesting that they, I just, as you said, I thought, wait a minute, this isn't because they didn't know how to do stories about with more than one character in a big story. Timely was doing it. So wait a minute. That's interesting. They did this on purpose, I guess, to do that spot so you could spotlight and say, oh, also appearing in leading comics, the Green Arrow, you know, Star Spangled Kid. It just hit me that way. And gosh, how did I not think of that before? It's like you don't put it together until you hear something just the right way. And however you said it, your words triggered my brain to shoot over to that tangent. But that was good. That's a nice comparison of the different styles of these old stories.
Yeah. Well, variety is a spice of life.
So in the opening chapter here, we get introduced to the Hand, who is the big villain, and he's a master criminal, we are told, and he's about to die, but he wants to utilize his knowledge and share it so other people can reap the benefits of his knowledge. And so the story is actually entitled The Blueprint for Crime. And he sends this information out to these other villains and tells them what to do. And part of it is kind of interesting. He baits the heroes with an announcement, you know?
Yeah, it's like it's a full page ad that he puts in the newspapers in all sections of the country, and it's like you said, it's the specific heroes. So I guess in a way they come together because they've been handpicked by the Hand, if you pardon the pun. So
that's just redundant. They've just been hand picked.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, I guess, you know, that's a sign of the times. If you're going to communicate with people, stick an advert in the newspaper. A little bit different to today, but it's quite an unusual way of doing it. And you know, I guess his motivations are pretty clear. If he finds out, or at least he thinks at this point, as we get to later, perhaps his diagnosis of being terminally ill wasn't quite accurate. It's pretty cool the way he does it as well. And he challenges them all to show up at a specific place and time, doesn't he? And the challenge is set.
Yeah, that is. He gets them all together. And that's so different from like the Justice Society, where they had own adventures and came together to have a discussion and meet, as opposed to, the original origin. The retroactive origin is they all go to fight Hitler in Europe and get the Sphere of Destiny, and they tell that story in the 70s. But they're this national team up. Where here it's for a reason they end up showing up together. Where here it's the bad guy's saying, you know, that calling them out like that's even more ballsy than the Riddler, you know, planting clues for Batman to find.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So the team comes together purely because the villains handpicked these specific heroes. If he'd have picked, you know, he could have picked other heroes, but he specifically picked these seven, to come together. So it's quite interesting that they're not together, like you said, they're not together through choice or through happenstance. It's basically just if the villain handpicked them, which is quite unusual.
Yeah. Now you've just given me a great idea that I'm going to have to follow up on sometime, and maybe you'll help me with it. I don't know, but I'm going to go back and try to find out what characters were not picked that could have been picked. Who were the remaining characters in these other titles in 1941 that they could have used on a third team? Like the, if these guys are the also-rans, the third team is like, you know, I don't know. I don't know what they are, but I got to look now. I got to look now.
Well, do you know what, Matt? It's funny you should say, because I was reading in the foreword to this collected edition, they do touch on it, believe it or not. There's a little passage here, and I quote, he says, two other likely candidates, both with superpowers, were inexplicably bypassed despite Weisinger's extensive involvement with the new title. Neither of his two other newly concocted creations, Johnny Quick, who debuted in September 41 in More Fun Comics, and Aquaman, who was November 41 in More Fun 73.
That's right.
They were bypassed. They could have been picked, Aquaman and Johnny Quick, but obviously history went a different way.
That's right. That's right. I'd forgotten I'd read that.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Would have been a very different story.
Well, they're the first two members right there of the team that never was.
Absolutely.
There they are. I'm going to do it. I'm going to pick them. I don't know what I'm going to do with them. I'm going to pick them. Paul Drass.
Yeah. Just imagine that if you'd have picked those two, and like the guy says, they were powered individuals as opposed to this lineup who very much aren't. You know, history could have been very different. But, you know, with Aquaman, if he'd been picked for these, maybe he wouldn't have been picked for the JLA and wouldn't have become the A-list character that he is now. It's crazy.
I'm glad you think of him as an A-list character, because I've always been a fan of Aquaman.
Yeah. Well, he is. Let's face it. He has his own title. And obviously it was a billion-dollar film, the last one, a sequel out next year. Or at least at the moment it's out, based on how one seem to want to move the goalposts every 5 minutes with casts and films. But it has been made at least, so should be out next year. So yeah, I do think he's A-list. Yeah,
that's one of those. At the time of this recording, the sequel's due out next year.
Yeah, subject to change.
The way things are going. I mean, I guess just yesterday we heard about Henry Cavill. I guess if that's real, so.
I know, yeah, all change indeed. It's going to be a very interesting few months to see what actually they are planning over there, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that sounds like it's a different podcast.
Yes.
But an interesting one nonetheless. So we opened the page, turned the page, and the first story is Green Arrow. And I made a note of some of the art, some stuff about the art and stuff, and we're going to try to touch on the art too a little bit. But with the Green Arrow story, what did you think about that? There's no trick arrows or anything. In my, you know, what I'm seeing is, you know, Green Arrow was always based on like bow and arrow version of kind of a Batman, you know, trope or analog. And it doesn't bother me. I actually happen to really enjoy these old Green Arrow stories a lot. And we get gimmicks like the arrow car. He's got the catapult seats. And at one point that car turns into a plane because of the wings that pop out, or the way it's drawn, you know, he's got like a wider base, like wings on it almost, but we don't get any trick arrows yet.
No, it's early days, isn't it? So we haven't quite gone that way. This is a bit more grounded to Oliver Queen, isn't it? Without the, all the technology at his fingertips. So, but I like it, like you might. I think it's a great, you know, caper. The character that they're there to rescue, I think he's called Cactus Mike. is a bonkers character who has like this pathological fear of the cold. So he's like permanently wrapped up, even though they're in wherever they're supposed to be in the Death Valley or wherever it is, where it's not going to be cold there, is it? But yet this guy thinks he's going to freeze to death. So it's kind of a crazy story. And I was going to ask you as well, actually, the adversary, Professor Merlin, it was Malcolm Merlin based on him. It's not the same character, is it?
Oh, right. it is not the same character, but he is definitely related. I remember reading in the Green Arrow archives, reading about Merlin and that, and having that same connection. Yeah, it's like that's where they got the name from, but he's not the same guy.
Right.
He is definitely a repeat Green Arrow villain. Definitely.
Right. I did wonder if they'd adapted the spelling of the surname or something like that for later, later antics or something, but I guess not. But no, it's a good fun romp, isn't it? You know, there's great escapes and amazing arrow archery accuracy and things like this. It's a really cool story, I think. It's good fun, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I really enjoy where they're shooting the bow and arrow with their teeth, or they've got their, there's no explanation of how they got their the arrows into their hands or into their mouths, or how they got the arrows out of their quivers when they were tied up, but they managed to somehow shoot a bow and arrow without using their hands and get the bow and arrow in, I don't know how they did it. I mean, I can't even, I don't think you could turn your head around and grab a bow out of your arrow out of your quiver. That would require Plastic Man like stretching powers.
I know, it does defy the laws of physics, doesn't it, really? But I suppose it's best not to think about these things too much, or else you'll tie yourself up in knots. But but it's good. I think he's quite quippy as well, Green Arrow, in this. He's got quite a lot of one-liners, and as he's sort of dispensing the fisticuffs to the villains, he's doing it in quite a jaunty way. It's quite a less serious Oliver Queen than where it went in the future, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's something I like about this era of Green Arrow from in the Golden Age, and even up until he gets the whole redo. I think it's 1969 in the issue of Brave and the Bold, where he suddenly socially conscious and has a different costume, and I don't know, there's something just sort of quaint and enjoyable about it without it being too serious, but it's still fun. I still get like a good camaraderie vibe between him and Roy, and it's a little more it's almost like it's the it's very much like Batman and Robin of the time, but I think because we're so used to Batman and Robin having growing into an adversarial relationship at times, that this is almost like a breath of fresh air from a modern reader looking back to it, because Speedy hasn't played a large role in your Green Arrow comic in a very long time. So, sure, we've read the whole Hard Traveling Heroes and all that, but I don't know that that defines the character quite as much as it could, because he comes out of it and that they've lost their animosity. Whereas we keep going back to the Dick Grayson Batman animosity just to keep the tension going, depending on who's writing Batman, I guess, at the time. But this sort of eschews all that, and it's a real sort of caring, father-son style relationship that they have. But yeah, it's just a fun little romp, like you said, with some good classic ground level action.
Yeah, absolutely. It's despite, obviously, like you said, the great escape and some of the trick shots they pull off, it's not so far-fetched that you can't take it seriously. Other than Cactus Mike's personality, other than that, it's a good read. I mean, the writing style is very much of its time, isn't it? With all that kind of interior monologue describing to the reader exactly what's happening, and there's a kind of a G Willikers kind of air to it all. But that's just representative of its time. I like it very much. Yeah.
What about the art by George Papp? He was the first artist on Green Arrow, and as a matter of fact, Green Arrow had only been in a few comics at this point. This is very early into his career. Do you like George Papp's art? I find George Papp to be a solid Golden Age artist, and reading a bunch of the stories in the Green Arrow archives, you know, really made me see that. George Papp will go on to draw Superboy and be the main artist on Superboy for a number of years in the 50s and 60s. But what about, yeah. What are your thoughts on him in here?
I like it very much. He does the art for the blueprint for crime story as well, doesn't he?
Both the bookend
bits of this issue. He does both the art for both of them. I think he's really good. Like you said, he's a very solid artist of that era, isn't he? There's great sort of, his action scenes have great sort of kinetic quality to them, the movements and the way he makes characters look as though they're moving through the air and leaping and what have you. I really like that. I think it's very eye-catching. I'm very much into it. It's like you said, much like the writing, it is of its time, but I think as a sort of representative of its time, it's top-notch.
I really like his depictions of the characters when they're firing the bow and arrow. You can really tell he's looked at somebody to see what does that look like. You know what I mean? It's like there's some funny things out there. Like there's this early Captain America story where he's playing baseball and he's at the plate and he's getting ready to hit the ball. And his stance is completely backwards. Like his feet are in the wrong position. It looks horrific. It's like you couldn't hit a baseball like that if you tried. But he really seems like he's looked at pictures of people firing bow and arrow and figured out what they're supposed to look like, and he gets it right. He really does get that right. I really think that's a nice touch, which is important for a character that, you know, is going to be firing a bow and arrow multiple times in an issue.
Exactly. You'd better get that right, eh?
Well, our second chapter is the Star Spangled Kid. And I think artistically, when you turn the page, there's a huge difference here. Hal Sherman, who is drawing this story, is a very has a very stylized approach. And I don't know, you know, if you like it, you know, that's fine. It certainly isn't really my taste, but you know, he doesn't necessarily do a bad job of telling the story, but it's such a shock to me from the more realistic looking George Papp stuff. It's a little cartoony.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, it's especially when you do go from Papp to Sherman, it's harder to take seriously, isn't it? It's a bit more almost comedic in a way. You know, his characters' faces don't look quite as realistic. There's a kind of an unusual quality to them with their eyes as well. I mean, you know, Pat Dugan looks borderline psychotic in some of these panels, which obviously that character isn't like that, but he's he looks very you know, sort of out there. But you know, I guess it's a nice bit of contrast, but yeah, like you said, it's Papp is probably the easiest to look at than this. I think this kind of style kind of takes you out of the story a bit, doesn't it?
A little bit, yeah. Although, you know, it's not too dissimilar from how Bob Kane was drawing before he got all that great help from people like Jerry Robinson.
Yeah.
You know, it's a more cartoony style.
Yeah, it is. But there's not that, you know, it's also, art is all subjective, of course. So our taste doesn't make it better or worse just because we like it less than Pat. But yeah, it's okay. I just find it, I personally just find it harder to get into and enjoy because it just seems a little bit off kilter, so to speak.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm in the same boat with you. But we do get to see things like the Star Rocket Racer in this.
Yeah.
I did find the bit with the coded maneuvers. He would, like, Star Spangled Kid gives Pat a number in just a sentence, and the guy's like, "What are you talking about?" And it's a secret move that they're going to use to escape or whatever. I thought that was a neat aspect of their fighting partnership. I'd forgotten about that, but that was really a neat difference. It sets sort of them apart from other other hero and sidekick stories.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, isn't it? Shows they're working very well in tandem. It sort of shows that they're obviously because when they're not costume superheroes, they're working together as sort of chauffeur and an employer or child of his employers.
Yeah.
So there's obviously a deep relationship there, and obviously they're spending a lot of time together. So it's good that they put that in there to show that they've done their homework. It's pretty cool. I mean, the one thing that really jumped out at me was the escape from the trap is very, very Batman 66. Like, basically, they're tied up on chairs and they're about to drown because they've let the water into the ship that they're on. But Star Spangled Kiss said, basically, when the needle tied him up, he had the presence of mind to flex his muscles.
Yeah.
And basically, that enabled him to sort of somehow escape the trap. And, that's very Adam West Batman. It is, isn't it? But I love all that. So that, to me, that was, I couldn't help but chuckle to myself when I read that.
Yeah. And like, if we had read that in Watchmen, we'd be like, what? But something like this, it fits. Yeah. It fits. It fits in it, and you just go with it because that's not the point of the story. It's the point is, you know, it's a fun romp again. A lot of these stories are fun romp type stories, but you know, it's just a different style. And no, I like that too. That's one of those kind of things where part of you wants to go, oh, come on. But at the same time, it's like, Well, you know, maybe the guy actually thought about it ahead of time, you know, maybe that's how prepared, you know, he is as a character. We should probably mention that just like in the Stargirl TV show, you know, Pat's the chauffeur and he's the sidekick to the hero, who is Sylvester Pemberton, the Star-Spangled Kid. I also thought it was interesting as I'm reading this, you know, I have a hard time of not hearing Pat's voice as Luke Wilson's voice from the show. And I thought it was really interesting how impatient he seems in this story, whereas Luke Wilson's stripesy in the TV show, of course, many years down the road in his own development, but he's so measured and cautious on that show. Whereas here he's like, come on, let's go. I'm ready to go. Let's go. What do you wait? You know what I mean? I thought that was an interesting difference in the characters.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a different take on the character, isn't it? He seems a lot more impetuous here than he is in, you know, I guess it's different in Stargirl because he's, as well as being a sidekick, he is a parent to the character as well. So there's that dynamic to the relationship, whereas here he's not Sylvester's parent. So it's a little bit different. But yeah, there is a stark contrast, isn't there? I suppose that when a character does become well-known through a TV show or a film, you do hear the actor's voice, don't you, when you read it?
Yeah, I was surprised. I didn't think I would, but I was reading it and going, I hear Luke Wilson's voice in my head. I got to get back to watching that show.
Yeah, it sadly just finished as well, which is a shame. But I enjoyed Stargirl. It was great that it brought a lot of these characters to the fore again and presented them to a new audience.
Absolutely. Well, Stripesy was always considered one of the Seven Soldiers, as was Speedy. But in the next section, we have the Crimson Avenger and the first character that is part of the team, but not part of the team, and eventually becomes a part of the team, even though he's not a part of the team. And if I said that twice, that's because it kind of feels that way when you go through it. So we've got the Crimson Avenger. He is another street level kind of hero. And originally he was more of a shadow type with a big cloak and a hat and a mask and 45s. And this is a costumed Crimson Avenger that is fairly different from that, but at the same time is still sort of inhabiting that same urban world. Yeah. What did you think about this one?
I like Crimson Avenger. I mean, I probably would have enjoyed it more if they'd retained that shadow air to him. I like that more than I like this red spandex. It almost reminds me of Starman a bit, his costume.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Golden Age Starman, doesn't it? It really is reminiscent of that.
Yep.
So I guess I would have preferred it if they'd not made that change and stuck with that Lamont Cranston, that's it, isn't it?
Yeah,
the Shadow. If they'd have stuck with that look. But no, I guess it works. I mean, I know we've discussed it before that the depiction of Wing, his sidekick, certainly doesn't age well in this day and age. It's a very sort of old-fashioned, stereotypical, borderline racist, dare I say, take on a Chinese man, which it isn't great in this day and age, is it, I suppose?
No, it's not. And it can be difficult at some points in the story. But at the same time, he's still written very capable and funny. He doesn't seem like he's not treated like a second citizen. He's just, you know, drawn that way, for lack of a better way to put it. But he reminds me a lot of Connie in the Terry and the Pirates newspaper strip, if you probably haven't read, but it's the same kind of thing. They're in that strip, they're actually in China, so they're around a lot of Chinese characters, and they fight the Japanese with the Chinese at different points. But this the way Wing is portrayed here is very much like Connie, with his quips, some of the things, the way he says things, and even his the way he's helpful. I mean, Connie is always helpful and capable, not just but capable. And Wing is the same way. They never depict them as being, you know, incapable. It's just that it was the mode of how to draw different looking people at the time. And we see that in other type stories as well. But I think if you can kind of find a way to get yourself through that, it's a pretty neat, it's a pretty good story too. It's another, you know, they figure out what's going on with some detective work and some mighty fine looking fisticuffs, the way the art is drawn by Jack Lady, which I think he's very good in this. A lot of his draftsmanship is quite good. He does seem to spend a little more time on the main characters and some of the background characters, but nonetheless, they look quite good in this.
Oh, I completely agree with you. Yeah, the panels where they're basically punching villains in the face, there's a lot of panels of that. The way he depicts the arm swinging round, and the sort of trail of movement, and quite often there's there's a page 37 of the book as it is. There's a wonderful panel there of Crimson Avenger whacking some guy in the face, and there's like an explosion of color behind the shot, which just emphasizes the punch in more detail. It's really good.
Yeah,
I think it stands up really well. I completely agree with what you said about Wing as well, despite the fact that the appearance is not good through the prism of being, you know, a more enlightened race that we are today. You're right in how the character is. He's very much on the ball, a great fighter, very much Crimson Avengers equal in many ways, rather than a mere sidekick. He doesn't let him down in any way. He's intelligent as well. It's just the way they make him look, with a very caricatured face, and some of his turns of phrase as well are quite dated. But no, the actual character himself is very much on an equal footing. So it's kind of unfortunate for Wing, isn't it, that they didn't make it the Eight Soldiers of Victory?
Yeah. Although just a little foreshadowing, he will eventually be considered the Eighth Soldier of Victory down the line. Go ahead.
No, that's good. I'm glad that he did get his due in the end, because as compared to the other sidekicks in this, he's every bit as good as they are, that's for sure.
Oh, he certainly stands with equal footing with Speedy, and he's you know, probably better than the Vigilante's buddy Billy Gunn, who
absolutely.
Although interestingly, we're not there yet, but interestingly, Vigilante gets a different sidekick later on. He gets a Chinese sidekick also at some point called Stuff, instead of Billy Gunn. But apparently there was some sort of overlap between the time Billy Gunn was appearing in Leading Comics, but he'd already been changed to switched over to Stuff in the regular series. So in action. So that's kind of a weird thing, but it's odd that we had two different Chinese sidekick characters. Well, the next page is the Shining Knight. And this is one of those characters I think is way underutilized. Just a lot of potential for a modern audience, I think, in comparing the modern world with King Arthur's world, sort of in a, you know, what do we value in the legends to compare, you know, what is the modern world, and of course the modern world being any time in the past 100 years, versus, you know, this ancient mythological world of King Arthur. What do we value about those days that the characters and stories are so so important to us still? And I think that'd be an interesting way to look at the character and examine it that way and see what it really was and what it wasn't, that kind of thing.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'd love to see him used more in current DC Comics continuity. There's so much you could do with him and have him interact with the heroes as they are now and what he could bring to it. It's a shame that we don't see him. Well, I can't remember the last time I read a DC comic, you know, a modern DC comic with Shining Knight putting in an appearance. I'd have to look that up. But it's a shame. There's a lot of ground to cover with this character. And I'm glad they gave him a good bit of, going back to the Stargirl show, I'm glad they gave him quite a bit of airtime in the first season there. And he actually got a lot to do. That was really cool. He was, with the, obviously the exception of Pat, obviously Sylvester comes into it at a later date. But at that time, he was the only other Seven Soldier who was depicted in the TV show, other than obviously the archive picture we spoke about. So it was great to see him get that moment to shine. But yeah, it is a shame. You're quite right. It would be great, and what you could do with him and his view on society and what have you, and how the world's changed for the better and for the worse since he was around in King Arthur's time. There's so much to be mined there, and I just wish someone would do it.
Yeah. Me too. It's lots of potential. I guess that's the thing. There's so many, at one point there were so many great characters with so much potential that they could never all be utilized to their fullest, which I guess is the great lament. I guess that's why we have other people coming in and taking these old characters and revamping them. Even Stripesy, for that matter, you know, what was done with him with Courtney in the comics is, you know, far and away, you know, a lot more relatable and I guess interesting than just the simple driver for Sylvester that we got in the Golden Age.
Yeah, it's I would have liked to have seen more, but and going back to this story, it's a good one. I like the interaction with the Native Americans. Again, that's a good juxtaposition of Native American and someone from Arthurian legend coming together, and the interactions between the two very different worlds colliding. I think it's really cool, and the art's great, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's Craig Flessel, and he was a early artist on Sandman.
All right.
And not the first one, but I thought he was at first, then I had to look it up and remembered the first Sandman artist is a guy named Bert Christman, who actually died in the war. But he did a lot of, he had work on early Sandman stuff, but then he did a ton of early superhero covers for DC. So like all those pre-Batman detective covers, there's a bunch of those that are by him. The same thing with like More Fun Comics and that kind of thing before Heroes got into there. He did a lot of those covers. So he's a name I'm pretty, one of the earliest names of the Golden Age I was familiar with, was all those early covers and stuff when I started getting into learning about the Golden Age. But yeah, the art's really good in this one. Probably a candidate for the strongest of the bunch, you know, I would say.
Yeah, I think it's really good. I like the villain as well. Red Dragon. Called.
Yeah.
Such an unusual look, isn't it? He's kind of dressed like Zatanna's father.
With
a face mask like Grifter from Wildcats.
Yes.
It's such an unusual mashup of costumes, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah, he's he's pretty ruthless too. He's like, I'll just shoot him.
Yeah, well, you actually see him actually murder somebody, don't you, in this?
Yeah.
Which compared to the other villains who were, you know, basically just gaining money or gaining power, this man is actually a ruthless killer. So it's a little bit of a harsher villain than we get in all the other chapters, isn't it?
And he's not like, I'm going to fill this thing with water and you're going to drown. He's just like, I'll just shoot you. Bam. Make it quick.
Exactly. Yeah. He's actually a bit of a forward thinker.
Yeah.
As opposed to most villains of the time, have to set a nefarious trap and then just walk off and leave you in the trap, you know, and don't watch for you escaping or anything like that.
Yeah, there's no chance. There's no way out. He's just going to shoot you. And then his sidekick or his henchmen will have, you know, Tommy guns and stuff, and the Crimson Avenger. That's where we get to see the armor, you know, protect him from the machine gun bullets.
Yeah. It's very cool. I do like it. Yeah. And obviously takes on a plane as well in the sky. It's very cool to see him in full flight. And, like we said at the start, it's a nice bit of something different from all these street level characters who are just relying on a good right hook. Whereas this is something a bit more, isn't it? A bit more fantastical.
Absolutely. So as we turn the page, we're turning over to the vigilante. Now, I will say outright that the art in this one by Mort Meskin is my favorite art of the book. We've talked about how good George Papp and Jack Laty and Craig Flessel are, but quite honestly, the vigilante story is my favorite art of the book. I absolutely love Meskin's approach. He's kind of got like Kirby's dynamic, but he's also got a little touch of a Will Eisner here and there and his faces and some of the shots he decides to take are just, you know, maybe unusual shots. It's my favorite art of the book and a real underappreciated, I think, golden age artist. I really wish more people knew about him and he was in more conversations, but I really love Meskin's work.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's beautiful to look at. Like you said, I think some of the angles he picks and some of the position, body positions that Vigilante takes when he's in action are slightly out there a little bit, but I really like that. I think it's very cool. And it certainly does grab you as a reader. It really does capture your imagination, demands your attention. So yeah, I think Meskin's work in this book is really something special.
Yeah, I just absolutely love it. I wanted to get that out of the way because I can go on about him for a long time. The last time I crossed his path in an episode, I had a hard time getting myself to stop talking about him.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's that good, isn't it?
I think it is.
So well done. It really is. It's great. For a character that's a bit of a, I guess by today's standards, if you came up with a character like this today, it would be considered quite hokey.
But yes,
it does work for the time. It's and I do like the story as well. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and the dummy, the villain in it, the dummy, he's in other vigilante stories. He's a recurring villain for the vigilante, and he
yeah.
What a different it prefigures Scarface, the Batman villain Scarface. You know, 40 years down the line.
It does indeed. Yeah, there's a lot of similarity there, isn't there, between the two? I didn't think about that until you just mentioned it. But yeah, you can clearly see maybe that was where the creator of said character got his inspiration, maybe. Maybe he went back to this and sort of kind of adapted bits of it for that creation. It could be.
But there's that one bit in the story where they're talking about, I'm not taking any orders from, you know, this ventriloquist doll, you know, that, you know, they're even saying, you know, somebody, one of us must be controlling him, but who is it? We've all left the room together. And then later on at the end, they found out like, oh crap, he's real. No one's controlling him. He's really, you know, he really looks like that. And he's the one who really, you know, given the orders. So it's a neat kind of difference from what we're used to with the ventriloquist. But of course, this came first, so it sets it up as a bit of a surprise that no one is controlling him.
Yeah, you do think he could be like a dummy or a literal. Well, he is the dummy, but I mean a literal dummy. But no, he's a fully formed character. It's pretty cool, and I like the way he's what he's doing to people, turning them to stone. That's pretty far out. But again, it works well and gives it a bit more jeopardy. The character of Vigilante is a bit of an unusual one. Is he supposed to be some kind of movie star or singer or something like this, isn't he?
Yeah, it's like a Roy Rogers type.
Gene Autry.
Yes,
kind of thing.
Yes. So that was something back in the 30s and 40s, a character that would appear in movies and stuff, but very often seemed like themselves because they would sing and they'd also have a little bit of a cowboy element to them. But yeah, this is kind of like that in the sense that that's what he does as like his day job, but he's also the Vigilante, but he wears the exact same clothes and the only difference is the bandana across his face is a mask. That's the only difference. His clothes are exactly the same, like when he shows up on set to film or whatever, he's wearing the exact same clothes, and I thought that just had to be the worst costume ever. We give Clark Kent crap about, Superman and the glasses, but here he's wearing the exact same clothes. It's like, oh, you're dressed like, I don't think his clothes are that common as a, I don't know, maybe all, singing cowboys wore the exact same clothes. So it could be any singing cowboy.
Yeah, it's kind of daft, isn't it, really, that no one would, especially because he's a celebrity as well. You know, he's not just some bloke. He's obviously this famous star.
Yeah.
So people know who he is. So surely someone would have pieced together, my God, this Vigilante guy is dressed just like Mr. Sanders.
Yeah.
Therefore it must be the same person. Is this Greg Sanders? Well, it could be. but yeah, it is a terrible disguise. I mean, when he first, as well, it made me laugh actually, when he first puts the mask on in this issue and he starts swinging through the other way, he goes, this is one way to avoid autograph hunters. Yeah. And it's like, well, no, you're not going to avoid any autograph hunters. You're literally just wearing a bandana across your face. They would all know it was you. So that's kind of crazy that no one would literally, but again, you have to suspend disbelief, I guess, don't you?
Yeah, I think you suspend your disbelief with that and then you get to see the great Meskin art and you go, okay, I'll buy that with that. And then the dummy is an interesting villain. There's a lot of interesting stuff in here. The story is, outside of the bad costume, it's a really strong story, I think, and set up for the villain just as a villain, whether he's in this story or multiple stories. It's a neat setup, and I think, the art does a lot in selling the excitement of the story.
Yeah, no, I did enjoy it a lot. It's one of all these stories we've talked about. This is obviously the last of the individual stories. I think it's as strong as any of the others, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's wrap it up with the final chapter where the Crimson, gosh, I'm looking at the book, where the seven soldiers all gather together again at that same location. And this time, oddly, the Crimson Avenger is wearing a cape. It's unneeded, but he's wearing a cape.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like, where did that come from, even? You didn't have one on the whole time you were actually doing your adventure. And where's poor Wink at this point? You know, why is he not there?
Yeah, he got left back in New York City. Lee Travis
Lee
Travis said, Wing, you got to stay home. Now, the retroactive continuity bit about why he was never considered a member was that Lee Travis wouldn't let him because he didn't want to get in trouble and get hurt, blah, 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 something like that. But he's tagging along in all the other stories. So it's one of those where the writers in the 70s tried to make an effort and it just never really,
Right.
It's still like, yeah, it's just crap. There's no real reason. There wasn't a reason. it just wasn't. And, interestingly, we'll talk about the number here in a minute, but we get the wrap up. And like you said, we find out the villain may not be he's not quite dead yet.
Exactly. Yeah. They never actually disclose what was wrong with him, do they? He just, at the start, he just gets told, you know, you'll be dead in a month. And then at the end here, the doctor's saying, oh, a famous surgeon has discovered a new way of treating cases like yours, you can be cured. But they never actually say what his disease or his condition was, do they? It's been, you know, you have to sort of come to your own conclusions, I guess. But yeah, I suppose it's weird because it's like all his motivation and why he did what he did with the heroes and recruiting the villains. It was kind of all for naught in a way, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was like he wasted all his great ideas on these other people and ends up, you know, having nothing to show for it. And now he has to figure out what to do against the seven soldiers, you know, once they come to get him.
Yeah. Yeah. It's you, in a way, I feel a little bit sorry for him actually, despite the fact that he's like this master criminal. I do actually think, oh, poor guy, you know, having gone through all that and this, he suffered the crushing disappointment of all these, his villainous allies coming up very short. And then at the end, he's like, oh, I could have pulled all those jobs myself. I actually feel a tiny bit, although he's a wrong un, I do feel just that little bit of sympathy for him.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely. Definitely. I know what you mean. I really like to see the use of the catapult and the arrow car on page 62.
Yes.
And I think 63 shows us why Crimson Avenger has a cape. It was just so George Papp could draw the cape on page 63 in the second panel. I think that's the reason. I think that's why he has a cape, because look at that cape. That's like a...
It is pretty cool.
It's a neat looking shot, and it's like you wouldn't get that without the cape. So...
Yeah, it is pretty cool. And it's great, actually, those couple of pages. It's each individual member. They're going through all these obstacles and traps that the hand has set for them. And that's pretty cool. And then, like we said, you actually finally get to see them come together and actually do some teaming up for once.
Yeah, you get to see them fight together in the same panels, which is something we haven't seen. And it really goes to that sense of, you know, it's a team book. They're a team book. They exist together. They're going to fight together to stop these guys, these bad guys together, not just, you know, individually. And of course the hand doesn't stand a chance against them. You know, they probably had struggles fighting, you know, one of them, let alone all of them together, all five of them, six of them, seven of them, eight of them, however many we're going to count it as. But the last panel gives us the first mention of the title Seven Soldiers of Victory. I thought it's interesting. It's in the last panel finally, but apparently it doesn't last for long because by issue 4, I believe they're called the Law's Legionnaires.
Yeah, I do wonder why they changed it up. It was, you know, was there a reason for that, or was it just an artistic choice? Or because I really like Seven Soldiers of Victory.
I think that's the thing there, is the title, The Seven Soldiers of Victory, is a better title, but I think, or name or whatever, but I think the fact that there were more than seven of them, they gave them a different name. And I don't know if they wanted to shy away from the soldier aspect because they weren't actually fighting on the battlefield where real soldiers are. By the time the fourth issue comes out, I think not only is America in the war, but people are going to now know actual soldiers in the armed forces that are doing that fighting, and these aren't soldiers in that sense. They are, you know, fighting crime. Well, it's a better title. I think maybe at the time it just sat better to say it sound like they were fighting against crime as opposed to actually fighting as soldiers of anything. You know, I think
you
just knew too many people in your own life at that point, you know.
I suppose, maybe it was construed as being disrespectful to the people who were really doing it for real and risking life or losing life. I guess it does make sense, but it's an interesting change. And like you said, when you're playing fast and loose with the number seven, I suppose it's better not to limit yourselves to seven.
Not keep bringing it up.
When there's eight or nine. So, yeah, I get the change, yeah. But it's obviously Seven Soldiers of Victory is the name that's endured, isn't it?
It is. When they come back, they are known as the Seven Soldiers of Victory, not the Law's Legionnaires. Despite the series running for the next, you know, through 14 issues of Leading Comics all quarterly. So that ends up being another 3.5 years or something that they're around until what, probably 40, I think 45 is the last issue. And then of course I mentioned that unpublished story that ends up being published in the 70s.
Yeah.
So, so these guys come back in the Bronze Age. In Justice League 100 through 102, we have a story that reintroduces them, where the Justice League has to go back in time, not in time, but they are thrown through time. The Justice League and Just Society have to find each individual member where they've been thrown to in time. And
yes.
And the villain in that story is actually the Hand, come back reinvigorated as the Iron Hand.
And is it the same man?
It is the same man, yes.
He's the same man.
Yeah, so that connects all the way back to their very first story, to this issue that we've just looked at. But he's called the Iron Hand now, and if you look at the splash page of this first story, we have this it's a metaphorical image of this big hand reaching out and holding all of the villains he has he's utilized to operate his, you know, his plans and his blueprint for crime. Well, in the story where they come back, there's actually a giant hand just like that that's going to crush the earth that the Iron Hand has somehow conjured up to actually crush the earth. So it's a lot taken from this story that goes into the return of the Seven Soldiers in the 70s.
That's cool that they did that, though, isn't it? It's cool that they managed to link it together and provide some form of continuity when quite often that's not the case. So I really like that. Like, I'm looking forward to reading it. Like we discussed, obviously, I've been listening to you talking about it, so I've invested in the book, so I can't wait to go back and read that story for myself.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really cool. And not only do they connect it in that way, but Wing ends up being the hero of the story once that saves everybody. He's the one that ends up sacrificing himself. So he actually gets his due finally and is truly a member of the team, even if it doesn't isn't reflected in the name Seven Soldiers of Victory.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool then. Again, that Wing has his moment to shine, you know, compared to, obviously we've spoken about his depiction in this and that the problems with that. So that's great that they made him the not the sacrificial lamb, that's the wrong way of putting it, isn't it? They made him the selfless hero when they brought them back. That's very cool. I do like that.
I think it's a way of giving him his due, like you said. Despite the depictions, it makes him, you know, it equalizes him in every level, you know.
Yeah, I think that's great.
Well, what else do you think you have to say? What else do you have to say about this story in particular before we sort of wrap up with some of the post Golden Age tidbits that are out there?
Yeah, no, I think it's great. I think it's, like we've said, it's of its time. Of course it is, because it's from the 1940s. So modern readers with modern sensibilities might find things that they don't particularly like about it. But I think it's great. I think it's really good fun. There's a sense of humour throughout it, which is important. They give these characters a moment to shine. Whilst I'm not massively a fan of the fact that there's very little actual teamwork in it and they're all sort of doing their own thing, but just happened to be pulled together at the end for a bit of teamwork. I would have liked to have seen them working in tandem more. Other than that, I think it's a really good read. I do enjoy it a lot. I'm so glad I've delved into it on your recommendation and gone in and enjoyed it. And it makes me want to try and read all that sort of first 14 issues, you know, the original run, just to get more of a flavour for it. But I think it's a really strong book, and I'd certainly recommend it to anyone who was looking to delve into it. Why not?
Cool, awesome. Hopefully they'll be able to find it at a reasonable price. These have been out of print for a while. I was lucky enough to get it when it first came out. Although there is a sweet spot with some of these things, you know, originally it was $50. You could probably find it for half that on eBay now.
Oh yeah, I paid a fraction of that on it to find this one on eBay. But trying to find it on eBay now, it's like you said, it's out of print, so it's just luck of the draw, right place, right time, really. So hopefully, you know, but I'd imagine they're available digitally, perhaps on, I don't know whether they're on the DC app. I'd have to look into that. But, you know, if you can find it and you see it at a reasonable price, I'd certainly recommend picking it up. It's great.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it that much, Max. I'm really glad you enjoyed it.
I did.
Have you any other, you mentioned All-Star Squadron with the appearance of the Shining Knight. Have you had any other encounters with the Seven Soldiers of Victory in any of their forms over the years? I know of a couple. We've talked about Stargirl TV show already, but did you remember reading Grant Morrison's Seven Soldiers of Victory, his series?
I've not read Grant Morrison's. No, I would like to. As I understand it, though, I know Shining Knight's still a part of that, but other than Shining Knight, I don't think, are any other members of this original lineup used by Morrison in his run?
Well, it's a completely different Seven Soldiers of Victory, and it's a completely different Shining Knight. It's not the same. Oh. It's not Sir Justin.
Oh, it's not Sir Justin, right?
No, it's another character entirely.
And
it ties into the retroactive golden age that DC had to create post-crisis. So it's it's not Green Arrow in the past. It's the character, the quality comics character, the Spider, that was used to take his place. And he was called the Spider, but he was a bow and arrow character. Don't ask me why. I couldn't make an argument for why that, but yeah, it was, it's Grant Morrison. So, you know, there's a chance it's going to be really good or just bizarre. And it's a little bit of both. It's got a bizarre quality to it, but it's got a really, but it actually is really good. And it goes over, what's it, five different miniseries or something. It's, or maybe more than that, because it's, the Manhattan Guardian, which is an updated version of the Guardian. It's
right.
I want to say Mr. Miracle in it.
Right. I think isn't Zatanna part of the lineup? She's there, isn't she?
Yeah. There's a Zatanna is in it. There's the new Shining Knight. Frankenstein is in it. The monster Frankenstein that we see later on in the New 52, but earlier. Yeah. And I didn't really look at anything to prepare that much, so I can't remember who else is in it at this point. I just know it's another take on the idea of the Seven Soldiers of Victory, but having only a tenuous connection to the original team. But he creates sort of an idea that there's a mystical thing with the idea of seven. Takes seven heroes to come together to stop whatever the horrible thing is that is coming. And actually, it's actually referenced again in, did you ever read Sideways when that was coming out?
No, I haven't read Sideways. No, I would like to, though.
There's an annual where Grant Morrison's New 52 version of Superman and the jeans and the t-shirt show up in that story. And it references a lot of what happens in his Seven Soldiers miniseries. So he likes to pull and such and connect. So that's pretty neat. I would recommend that if you can get that. It's long because it's like multiple miniseries interconnected, but it's good. It's good. It has almost nothing to do whatsoever with the original team, but it's an interesting reimagining of the concept of Seven Soldiers of Victory for a totally different reasons. But
yeah,
it's fun. And of course the Stargirl TV show is probably the place that's going to get the most attention these days. And the current Stargirl and the Lost Children miniseries that Jeff Johns is reading, there's going to be a lot of connection with that because Wing is actually referenced in there in his sacrifice. So it's all starting to come together again.
Oh, right. That's cool. That's something, you know, whatever people think of Jeff Johns, he is very good at linking back to characters from yesteryear and playing homage to them, isn't he? I think that's something that he's always been very good at, especially when he did his JSA run and things like that. He's great at linking the new with the old.
He is, and that's one of the things I've liked most about his writing, is being able to take those things and connect them and build on them and make them fit without throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as it were. You know, maybe you want to get rid of some ideas, but you don't have to destroy everything in the past just to make your idea work. And not everybody can do that. Johns does a good job with it. Morrison very often does the same kind of thing. I think utilizing the Batman of Zur-En Arr is a great example of that. You know, who would ever have thought that you could use that in a modern story, but he found a way to do it. So it just adds that something extra. And I think that Johns is able to do the same thing. And it helps older readers that lament for an older timeline or a previous continuity. It helps. And I'm speaking of myself, of course. It helps me stay engaged. Whereas you change everything, you start to lose me after the third or fourth, you know, reimagining. It's
I'm with you on that, Matt. I like that through line of continuity, and a sense that you're still linked to all these decades of history rather than just completely throwing it all out and starting from scratch. I like the fact that you can refer to characters and bring characters from the 1940s and 50s and 60s and present them for a contemporary audience. I think that's something he's as good as anybody at. And the way he can bring these characters to life is great. And what you're saying there about the new Stargirl comic that he's writing with the reference in Wing, I've not started reading that yet, actually. I've got the issues, obviously, digitally ready to go, but I haven't delved into them. So I'm definitely going to, based on that.
Well, make sure you read, it came out in May of 2021. The Stargirl Spring Break Special. That actually,
oh, I did read that. Yes,
you read that. Do you remember that? Okay, so you remember what they did with Green Arrow in that, or do you not remember?
I do not remember. No.
If you remember, Ollie and Roy go back in time from the present to be the Golden Age Green Arrow in the Seven Soldiers of Victory. So
yes,
I wasn't sure how I felt about that at first. I want to see how it plays out. But it's an interesting idea. In order to restore a Golden Age Green Arrow, he's found a way to do it. So instead of relying on, you know, Winged Victory, the horse being one of the Seven Soldiers, or having to utilize the spider as a Seventh Soldier in Green Arrow's place, it's actually our modern day Green Arrow going back in time to be that Green Arrow. I thought that was a pretty interesting. And in one sense, I was like, oh, that's really cool. Another sense, I was like, I got to see how this plays out. Because the whole time travel thing gets so... Sometimes time travel works, and it's enjoyable to see, I guess, like Superboy, at least from the Legion stories I like, to see Superboy go to the future and be in the Legion. It's another thing to send a modern character back and be a character in the past. I don't know how that works yet.
Yeah.
But I'm curious. But I'm certainly intrigued and interested to see how it plays out, and I'm sure that's going to be part of what happens in the Stargirl and the Lost Children miniseries that's coming up. That's currently being published. So yeah. I'll be there for that, right with you.
great stuff! Exciting times ahead.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Max, let's wrap it up. I want to thank you again so much for joining me today. I'm glad we got to do Seven Soldiers. It's a perfect topic for the Classic Comics show. And I'm really glad to have somebody to talk to about it. I originally wasn't sure how I would work in guests with my format, but I think after today, I'm 100% sure how it's going to work going forward when I have guests. So I want to thank you for joining me on this episode. And of course, this episode, especially with trying out my different format. So I really appreciate it. And it's been great to talk to you today.
Oh, Matt, the pleasure is all mine. I'm honored to be asked on. I'm a big fan of what you do with the Golden Age era of things. I love, you know, I love the history of comics, and I love it. You know, when you do your show, I always find like I'm being taught, I'm learning something every time. So to actually be invited on to have a chat is a great honor for me. So I must thank you rather than you thank me. It's a real treat to be on. So thanks for inviting me on. I've had a great time. Thanks so much.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that. And that means you're going to come back at some point. I know.
Oh, absolutely, I will. Yeah, next whenever you'll have me, I'll be there. I'll be there. I'll be the wing to your Crimson Avenger.
Awesome, sounds great, Max. All right, Max, tell everyone where you can be found on the internet.
You can find me on Twitter at MaxyByrne, which is spelled MaxyByrne. If you go there, there's links to the various websites that I write articles and bits and pieces for, and obviously a link to the Fantastic Comics in Motion podcast page, which of course is why we're listening to this show. So by all means, check it out and say hi, and thank you very much.
All right, help everybody, help me send off everybody, Max, with a good sign off of telling everybody to go read some comics.
Well, you heard what the man said, go read some comics.